Flames of Discontent, the 1916 Minnesota Iron Ore Strike, is a new book from the University of Minnesota Press by Gary Kaunonen. And Gary is an independent historian of labor and immigration and a documentary filmmaker, and he's based in International Falls, where we're reaching him tonight. Good morning, or good evening, excuse me. Welcome to the Roadhouse.
Well, thank you, Jay. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, first of all, before we go any further, talk to me about the St. Paul Friends of the Library. This is something you just found out about yesterday.
Yeah, this was actually quite the good news. The book has won the Hognander Award for scholarship, mm-hmm. and it was, quite a deal, something you don't necessarily expect, but I got the news from the press, and first thing I did, and I kind of want to point this out, is that I thanked my editor and all the folks at the University of Minnesota Press, because as I said, I think to the producer, my name goes on the front of the book, and I've certainly put a lot of work into it, but the folks at the press really put it across the finish line, and the work that those folks do, it goes unheralded, but when something like this happens, it's really a collective effort.
Well, and well-deserved, I might add. I can't remember when I've enjoyed a book of history centered here, where I live, pretty much, as much as this one. I learned an awful lot. I want to say that I had a good friend who has passed away a number of years ago, who was extremely interested in the whole IWW labor movement, and we would talk about it every time he came to visit. And so this book is as much a history of the wobbly movement and socialism on the range as it is about the Rangers themselves. So you come from a mining background, and you heard stories of the early miners at your grandmother's dinner table. And so talk some about the things that you learned about your own family history.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the preface of the book really starts off talking about that, to kind of bring my interest in the topic to light. And my parents were both Iron Rangers and grew up on the range, and then, like a lot of Rangers, moved south in kind of a bus cycle on the range and ended up a little bit north of the cities area. But we would go back up to the range quite often, summers and holidays and that type of thing. And of course, there was my dad's family's place, homestead. It was sauna night, was Saturday night, so we'd go. We'd take sauna, and then the adults would sit up around after having a beverage. And I was, too young to be involved in some of those conversations, at the table. So I would kind of go upstairs, and my brother and I would be upstairs, and we were supposed to be sleeping, but I would kind of peek down. There was a heat register, and I'd peek down that looked right down on the table, and I kind of listened to it. And I heard everything from what the politicians weren't doing right to fishing, to Twins, but within to the Minnesota Twins, how they were playing. Mm-hmm. But within those conversations, there was, it was a type of class consciousness that, talking about work at the mine and the benefits and the problems with the USW, United Steelworkers. And it was a rich kind of, it was a rich tapestry. There was a lot of stuff going on within the conversation, but it gave me this background that made me want to think about or do some research and study into some of the things they were talking about. And as I kind of moved backwards from those conversations, this was in the, the early 80s, and mid 80s. And as I started and I went into college and then had that background, and then started to kind of look where some of those discussions about class consciousness started on the Iron Range. And that got me back into the early 1900s and 1910s and some of the union and socialist movements that were occurring within the Finnish and the Italian and the South Slavic population.
Well, this is really the period you're talking about is really a period about immigrants, and of course we're talking about immigrants right now on this scene. But you paint a pretty bleak picture for miners and immigrants in general in the late 19th into the early 20th century, much more so than I ever realized.
Yes, conditions weren't great. Socially, environmentally, they weren't great on the ranges. There was a lot of crime, a lot of vice, and living conditions especially were really a problem. In one part in the book I talk about, there were several epidemics, fly-borne epidemics and diseases. And some of the camps, there was really a couple of different types of what they call camps on the Iron Ranges. And these were the places most time that single men who had just come within the last couple of years, where they were living. And these camps were, one was described as being stuck in a foul-smelling mud hole, diseases being rampant around the area. So it wasn't good. And, of course, there were really... You know, there were nice things, and there were parts of society that were, you know, quite elaborate and well-to-do. But, you know, for an area that was kind of dominated by immigrants, the conditions, especially for the immigrants, living conditions especially, weren't very good.
Well, you talk about the immigrants. Talk about the mix of Finns, which I'm taking as your own heritage, and the so-called Austrians. They were referred to as a generic group of people. They were anything but.
Yes. Austrians were coming from what was known then as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And significantly, of course, to give some context here, they were involved in World War II, which was raging in Europe at the time. It had started in 1914. Mm-hmm. And so the Austrian immigrants some of them were fleeing some of what was going on in Europe. But the Austro-Hungarian Empire was ruled by Germanic people. And the Austro-Hungarians, or the Austrians as they were called, that were coming here were from Slavic origins, so they were kind of second-class citizens within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And so, they arrived, throughout the early 1900s, but a number especially were brought in during the 1907 Mesaba strike.
Let's be clear, because you've mentioned a couple of times Iron Ranges, plural. There's three of them, right?
Yes, yep. You got me. I'm ahead of myself here, but yeah. So there's the Mesaba Range, which was, of course, the largest. There was the Vermilion Range, which was the first, and then there was the Cuyuna Range, which kind of was found by happenstance down around Crosby and the Ironton area. Mm-hmm. And so all of these ranges, the Cuyuna kind of finally came online in about 1911, but the Mesaba was kind of the big one, and the one that was targeted most often by union organizers.
Well, now, these miners were considered unskilled laborers, and they didn't have hardly any workplace benefits. So talk about the role of the mine bosses, management, and especially then the entrance of the IWW and unionization, because that's a big part of this book and a really fascinating part.
Yes, certainly. There was a lot of tension between unskilled laborers, and unskilled laborers were, we think about mining and miners as kind of being this monolithic idea, but within mines, there were a number of different jobs, and unskilled jobs were the really, really difficult ones. You were oftentimes, it was called mucking or laying track. Mucking would be taking rocks that were blasted, lifting them into a mine cart, and pushing this mine cart. Just really physical and back-breaking work. And these were the folks that were least represented in mines, oftentimes couldn't speak English, of course. And some of the skilled occupations were organized already by the American Federation or the AFL. And the skilled workers weren't. And oftentimes those skilled workers were, of course, Finns, Austrians, Italians and some other ethnicities. And so they didn't have any type of representation. And one of the big problems during the 1907 strike and the 16 strike was that the bosses, the petty bosses or mine captains, there was a system of graft that was occurring in the mine where they would, you'd have to basically pay for your job. And so that was one of the real kind of problems between the unskilled workers and the bosses. And so nobody really wanted to represent the immigrants because they were difficult to organize, spoke a number of different languages, and, you know, they didn't have a lot of money to pay towards union dues, frankly. And so there weren't a lot of unions until industrial unions, such as the Western Federation of Miners, the WFM, and then later in the 16th strike, the IWW or the Wobblies came in to organize them. And the Wobblies had a rich, radical, and really, really interesting history, and that's the kind of the focus of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they did find pretty fertile ground with the unskilled laborers and the Finnish population. I've always been fascinated by this, and you go into great detail, but talk about the very socialist culture of the Finns on the range. I mean, they had a long tradition of pretty left-wing politics.
Yeah, it's a really amazing story what Finnish immigrants brought as far as radical politics in the U.S. And there's some kind of debate between whether or not it occurred, they became radicalized in Finland, which at that time was a part of the Russian Empire, mm-hmm. or they became radicalized in the U.S. I think you can make an argument either way, but conditions in the U.S. were certainly ripe for Finns to be kind of a bit disgruntled. And they came to the U.S. and had a really good hall culture, kind of like a social hall culture. Mm-hmm. And so really a lot of the political movement starts from within this hall culture. And it starts in the temperance movement and with the liberal wing of the temperance movement and then moves into socialist politics. And the Finns were the largest. There were language federations within the Socialist Party of America. And the Finns had the largest, by far the largest, language federation within the Socialist Party of America. And we see that being expressed on the Iron Ranges through all of the social halls, some of them still standing. The Virginia Socialist Opera House, which still stands today a block off of Chestnut Street in Virginia, that was built in, I think, 1909 or 1910 in Virginia and was the strike headquarters. And there were all of these in every little community. Many of them had a socialist hall. Hibbing had one. Nashawak had one. Aurora had one, a socialist hall and a cooperative of some type. And the Finns really led, especially the 07 strike, were blacklisted along with the number of Italians from that strike and moved out to these little farm areas, Embarrass, Finland, along Highway 1 there, Cherry, all of these different areas, and started farming and began kind of, there was they moved out and were blacklisted and began political organizations in these small areas. And then when the 16th strike happened, they helped by having the Finn halls, but they also gave kind of material support. So they were sending potatoes and other things into cooperative stores during the strike. And they didn't have boots on the ground in the mines as much because they'd been blacklisted, but they were kind of a support network for the Slavic people who were kind of really at the forefront at the 1916 strike.
Well, I want to say that this book is heavily illustrated with some great and very fascinating old photographs. So some of the things that you're describing are easy to understand by looking at the photographs, more so even than a description. So let's spend another minute or so on the social halls, because what I found really interesting is the role of labor songs, poetry, theater. It wasn't just people standing around doing town hall stuff. They were using art forms that were a part of their culture to describe their condition. The labor songs are very graphic about the conditions, and it just seems that you got these rough and tumble guys in dirty boots and shovels in their hands all singing songs.
And that comes largely through the Wobblies. The IWW was known as the Singing Union.
Oh.
And I think one of the pictures in the book, and it's a great photo. I do a lot of material culture studies, which kind of looks at artifacts. Mm-hmm. One of the great pictures in the book is an old Wobbly. It's called the Little Red Songbook to fan the flames of discontent, and that's kind of where the title of this book comes from. And within that Wobbly songbook, there's number of songs: Pie in the Sky, Dump the Bosses Off Your Back. But then the owner of that book pasted in some Finnish language songs that he preferred, or she preferred more. And so you have all these classic Wobbly songs, and then in there is this kind of paste job of some Finnish songs. I think they're mostly lumberjack songs. And so these books, and you could, you could purchase them. They were quite, they weren't going to cost an arm and a leg, so to speak. And these books were just rampant all over the place, ubiquitous at meetings. And, everybody had one. And sometimes the songs, this was really smart by the Wobblies. Sometimes these songs were set to tunes, old religious hymns. And so people would know, kind of instinctively know the tune, and then learn the words, so they could sing along very easily, because the cadence and the rhythm of the song went back to these religious songs that many of them had heard, just with new kind of class-conscious words. And so there was a lot of thought, and there was a lot of kind of precision to what was going on within the labor halls. And of course, that's the idealized scenario. There were also places where you could just come and complain about your workplace. There were, of course, a lot of courtships that began in the social halls. And of course, even though it was frowned upon, there could be a lot of other types of merriment that were going on as well. The halls, we kind of think of them, they weren't as didactic and as, you weren't being beaten over the head all the time by ideology. They were kind of meant to be a place where you could come together and, talk about or read Marx or some of the anarchists that were associated with the movement. But you could also come there and just be around people who spoke the same language as you. They acted as kind of homes away from your home in the old country.
Well, the book is centered, of course, around the big 1916 strike, and there's a lot of detail on that in there and a lot of key figures, and we don't have a lot of time left here. I wanted to talk a little bit about considering the diverse and dynamic mix of ethnicities, culture, politics, fierce individuality and pride in being the working class on the Iron Range. How does this history inform the range today? Are they still very working class oriented, or has the landscape changed?
Well, I'm not a native Iron Ranger. And so most of what I kind of grew up with was listening to my parents and my grandparents. And there was a definite, in that generation, there was a definite class consciousness. Mm-hmm. There was a definite meaning to being a ranger. And as most people know, when you come to the range, there's, the range has its own dialect. Mm-hmm. And there's that kind of working class consciousness that gets expressed through, there's still union memberships. If you go into Virginia, there, what I call the Union Avenue, There's the Laborers Union. The USW has some offices in Virginia still. And so there's, I think, a definite working class culture, but it may get expressed a little differently than, you know, what we see in 1910. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of reading going on. And so the working class culture at that time was kind of centered around education and information. And I think, you know, that may have shifted a little bit. You'll see that kind of pop up every once and again. But in my opinion, that kind of comes when there's a crisis, mm-hmm. you know, when a plant is going to get shut down, or, you know, when a mine loses jobs or, you know, something like that. And there, that maybe that foundation of class consciousness and working class culture has slipped a little bit. And then when it's time to meet and rise to a challenge, people will kind of get together and, you know, raise kind of a mass voice at that point. But that foundation only gets expressed in those times of kind of turmoil. And I think in 1910, what they were working towards more so was a revolutionary restructuring of society. That certainly was the IWW's mm-hmm. goals. And I think, and I don't want to frame it as a complacency, but today I think maybe kind of lost that radical or that revolutionary perspective, and it'll pop up now and again, and you'll see people in the street when something kind of bad is happening, but that perspective just kind of has peaks and valleys, and that's maybe, for me, the biggest difference. In 1910, it was a constant stream of thought, and now it kind of pops up now and again when it's needed.
Well, before I let you go, we've got a couple of minutes left here. The 1916 strike, things got pretty heated and even violent. There were some key figures, and two of them that really caught my attention, Big Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Talk a little bit about each one of those.
Yeah, well, they were interesting, specifically because Big Bill Haywood had been, you know, rank and file before he took over as the general secretary of the IWW. He was, as the name implies, he was a big dude, mm-hmm. and had lost an eye in, I think it was his left eye. So in most of the photos you'll see of him, he's at the profile where he has his one good eye. And he was kind of a rowdy, really enjoyed the kind of Western persona. He came from out West. He was a ranch hand for a while. So he really kind of embodied that figure of the mining American West and carried that, you know, carried that with him. And really was a guy that kind of personified the values of the IWW.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Now, there's an interesting character.
Yeah, and why, you know, at this time, she was dating Carlo Tresca, who was the Italian anarchist that was up on the range here and had been arrested, actually, and deported. They took him and a couple of the other organizers and deported them from the ranges to Duluth, and then Elizabeth Gurley Flynn came up and was, you know, very concerned because he was arrested for first-degree murder, even though he was not around the murder. He was arrested basically for inciting the murder. And, you know, so then they brought Elizabeth up because she was the real star of the IWW. She was a force of nature. She had been here during the 07 strike and had married a guy by the name of Jack Jones, who was a WFM member. The Western Federation of Miners organized that strike, and she married him. It didn't work out too well. It was kind of one of those things they got caught up, and it was impassioned and fell out of touch, came back in the 16 strike, and really tried to resuscitate the strike. She was one of those figures that some of the newspapers in the area were very critical of other IWW organizers, calling them, you know, ragtag and, you know, other things and thugs and things like that. But then Elizabeth Gurley Flynn comes up, and she had these kind of middle-class appurtenances, you know, very nice hairs in a bun, was, you know, Catholic, and she was just, you know, dark flowing hair. And really, when she got on a platform to speak, crowds listened, and she was the all-star of the IWW organizers. And even the newspapers that weren't so hot about the IWW, they weren't, and the strike in itself, they had to admit that she could give just a real rousing speech. And so she became really one of the all-stars. But then, because of Haywood's handling of the arrest of Kreska and the others, Haywood wanted to let them sit in jail. And since Carlo Tresca was dating Elizabeth Gurley Flynn at the time, she didn't think too much of that. She left, both she and Tresca left the IWW. So there was a falling out that happened after the 1916 strike, which was really important to American labor history because it kind of fractured the IWW, and they really struggled kind of getting back on track after the 16 strike.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Gary Kaunonen. He is the author of Flames of Discontent, the 1916 Minnesota Iron Ore Strike. We're getting a lot of information, but trust me, this is not a 7,000-page book. It's fascinating. It's filled with great photographs. You can picture these people because you're going to be looking right at them. And again, congratulations on your award from the St. Paul Friends of the Library. And good luck with the book. I really recommend it for people that want to know something in depth about our own Iron Range and all the struggles and the ethnic mix and just a lot of great stuff. So thank you for joining us, and good luck with the book.
All right. Well, I appreciate the interview, Jay. Thank you very much.